Welcome to The Shed Wireless, a podcast for shedders, produced by the Australian Men's Shed Association and hosted by John Paul Young.
Yeah, there's something for you at the Men's Shed.
Hello and welcome back to the first Shed Wireless podcast for shedders in 2024. It's great to be back. We're made in Australia and distributed all over the world. What an episode we've got for you today. Our shedder in the spotlight played first grade for St George Dragons Rugby League Club in the Never Before, Never Again era, 1956 to 1966. Johnny King is now the chief clock repairman at the Maitland's Men's Shed, and we had a great chat. My special guest today is Lawson Dixon, CEO of the Black Dog Ride, who are fantastic supporters of the Men's Shed. The One Dayers are coming up soon this month, and Lawson told me all about it and how and why the Black Dog Rides got started. On the tools, I talked to Grant Robinson, who started tinkering with tools from a young age. I had a yarn to him about some of the fascinating projects he's worked on since. What a guy. Talking about when your time is up isn't easy, and we tend not to think about it, let alone talk about it, but it's something we really ought to do. So in this month's On the Pulse, we had our very own Stuart Torrance invite funeral director Imelda Woods to chat about exactly how you can organise your very own send-off. And Rip Woodchip, well, he's yarning about some serious stuff today too. Finally, in Max Music Shack, we're hitting the open road and diving into the exhilarating world of road-tripping songs. Well, let's get into it.
You're listening to The Shed Wireless with my good friend, John Paul Young. It's a podcast for shedders across Australia and around the world. Get ready to shed.
Yeah, there's something for you at the Men's Shed.
Johnny King, an Australian former rugby league footballer and coach, was a winger with the St George Dragons for the last 7 years of their 11th consecutive premiership winning run from 1956 to 1966. He was a representative in the Australian national team from 1966 to 1970, earning 15 test caps and has been named among the nation's finest footballers of the 20th century. He is now an active member of the Maitland Men's Shed here in New South Wales. We're here at the Maitland Men's Shed, and I've got a very special, special guest. This is John King, and John's in charge of doing all of these clocks and making them up and fixing them. John, what an amazing job you're doing. It's incredible.
Oh, it gives me something to do of a morning, you know. I'm retired now, and I've nothing to do at home, and only annoying my wife, so she thought it might be better if I joined the Men's Shed.
Well, you're doing an amazing job. Now, John, before we get right into the clocks, you've got quite a history. You used to play for St George.
Yes, I played for St George. Yeah, I played from 1959, but I went into first grade in 1960 and played from 60 till 71. I played in seven out of their 11 grand finals.
Seven out of the 11, the famous 11 grand finals that St George won. And you scored a try in every one of them.
Every one, yeah. And he's deceased now. Eddie Lumsden used to be always here at the Men's Shed too. Yep. He was the other winger.
Wow. I think I might get a pen and paper, John, and get you to sign a whole lot of autographs. I'm heading down to St George. I can sell them.
Don't worry. I've had people from next door go down and said they've gone into the Leeds Club and said, oh, I'm a friend of John King, the footballer. Yeah. Any chance of having a look at the exhibition downstairs? And they've opened the exhibition up downstairs so they can go and have a look. I said, they're getting more credits than what I did and I played.
Right. Any of these clocks that have really stumped you?
Oh, no. We've got one. No. Oh, yes, we've got one that's causing us a bit of problem at the moment.
Yeah.
It's very old and we're trying to make up a part for it.
Oh, that's that one you were showing me before,
yes,
yeah?
Yes, John, yeah.
The little lever?
Little lever. We're making up a lever for it. And if we can get it to go, it'll look like that. Oh, it'll look like that one that's on the desk there.
Yep.
And it's over 100 years old. So
fantastic.
It's like I explain to people when they bring them in, we just can't walk down to Coles or Woolies and buy parts. You got to make them.
Yep.
And they've got to realise, being very old, and it takes a lot of skill to get some of the men here to make things up for me, to make the clock work.
I mean, just like most kids, I suppose most boys pulled apart an alarm clock when they weren't supposed to. Couldn't get it back together again. I know I was one of them.
Oh, don't worry. You weren't on your own. I did when I lived at Gilgandra. I said, that's how I started. I pulled the alarm clock up. Gently I was, undoing it, and then it blew up in front of me, and I said, imagine what I said. Bits are flying all directions, and my grandmother wasn't very impressed. But that's where I started, a West alarm clock, yeah, Big
right.
Ben. Yeah,
Gilgandra. I drive through there every now and again. Now, all of these are just brought in by local residents?
Oh, the people are brought in and just asked, could I get them to go for them? Most of them, as you realise, they're all old. They're all, yeah. Like the ladies that bring them in. And it's either a wedding present or it's a grandmother's present that they've had for years. And just ask, could I get them to go for them? So I go to the trouble, pull them all apart. And I've got boxes of old movements that belong to some different clocks. And we take parts from one... pinch from one to make another one work.
Right.
And we just turn it down and rejoin the little wheels up and get the clock going for them. And all we ask them is give a donation to the men's shed when they go. They're quite happy. They're pleased. They've come in with their clock not going and going home with their clock going. And
yeah, they say that you should never have a clock in your house that doesn't work.
No. Well, I know. I say that when I go to some of the homes to have a look at their grandfather clocks and grandmother clocks. And I'm a great believer. No use in having a clock in the house if it don't go. It should be on the time.
Oh, well, you convinced me. I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back with two.
Oh, that's all right. That way we get people bring them in, especially when they said, oh, will you come and pick up my grandfather clock? And when you finally get there, the clock's 9 foot tall, and you go, say, should I pick tall to put in my car? I might come back with a truck and we'll pick it up in the truck.
Well, John, thank you very much for having a great chat with us about the clocks. It's a great service that you do, because there's, you can't, like you say, you can't just go to Woolies and Coles and get bits for these things.
Oh, no, no.
So
very
it's fantastic.
Old.
And congratulations on a fantastic football career.
Oh, thank you.
Well done.
All right. Thank you very much.
No worries.
Thanks, John.
We acknowledge the Wanneroo people, the traditional custodians of the land on which the members of the Maitland's Men's Shed meet, and we pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Our special guest is Lawson Dixon. This is all about the Black Dog Ride. It began in 2009 to raise awareness of depression, and it evolved into a national charity involving thousands of Australians, raising millions of dollars. Well, Lawson, maybe we should start with the history of the Black Dog Ride. How did it all start?
Well, it's a great story. The ride started back in 2009 with the founder, Steve Andrews, suffered the loss of of his friend's wife, his best mate, she took her own life out of the blue. It was a shock to everyone. And he realised then that not a lot of people were talking about suicide, not a lot of people were talking about depression. A lot of people were masking it. And there was really sort of a stigma attached to both depression and suicide. Steve's a fairly insular character himself. He's founded this amazing movement, but he's not as outgoing as we'd love him to be. He thought, you know, what can I do about this? He jumped on a motorbike, and his job was to raise awareness. He wanted to ride around Australia, raise awareness for depression and suicide prevention. He did that. It took him about 35 days. He took with him a small plushie black dog called Winston, which was the origins of the mascot, and he travelled around the country, got back to Busselton in Western Australia after 35 days on the road, and he'd raised about $35,000 along the way without really sort of trying to do anything. This was back in the days when there wasn't a lot of people having a conversation, and we're quite proud of the fact that Steve was out there and he felt that having a conversation about depression and suicide prevention was actually really, really important.
Is this where the black dog thing came from that dog, or was that a saying that was already established?
Well, it's really, that's an interesting story as well. Winston Churchill wrote in his diaries talking about the black dog of depression, which would follow him around.
Yes, I remember now, yes.
Right. And so obviously Steve recalled this, and that's how Winston got his name. And so our mascot of the black dog that you'll see that accompanies many of our riders on the ride is called Winston. And obviously, that's where that comes from. So that's a wonderful story in and of itself.
Sure. So what do you do on this ride?
Well, so there's a number of different rides. So that very first one was a circumnavigation of Australia. He went anti-clockwise from Busselton and ended up back in Busselton and essentially founded a movement. But then in 2010, his followers in Busselton and in other places around Australia decided to do what we call now the One Dayer. And that's where, not everybody can take 35 days off and belt around Australia on a motorbike. But a lot of people can take a Sunday off and help with raising awareness. So the One Dayer was born, and we've been doing that now, I suppose, around Australia for since 2010. Very first ride was in Busselton, and then places like Gold Coast and Dubbo and a few others started up quite quickly after that. And so the ride is always held on the third Sunday of March every year. And this year we're heading back into pre-COVID levels of participation, where we're hoping for 51 separate rides around the country. And we're hoping for around about 7,000 participants this year. So, if we can do that, we're over the pandemic slump, if you like.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing success. There's no doubt about that. From its humble beginnings. So when you're on the ride itself, what do you do exactly? You just go from point A to point B, but what else?
Yeah, good. Well, very first thing is that the ride provides a mustering point for participants and the general public alike. The use of motorcycles is a conversation starter. Our mascot Winston, again, a conversation starter, and the whole idea is that it gets people talking, not necessarily about depression or suicide at first, but it can be a gentle introduction into the topic without actually confronting it head on, which can sometimes be a bit of a problem. And the guys in the men's sheds know this as well. Blokes don't talk face to face; they talk shoulder to shoulder. And that holds true, particularly in the early days of the levels of stigma that went around mental health issues and particularly that of suicide. So, on a typical ride day, the participants would get together. They'd meet at the mustering point, which is generally a central location. They're getting bigger and bigger. Guys like Busselton meet in a staging area that's provided by a longtime supporter of ours down there, Toyota Busselton, and big enough for a couple of hundred motorcyclists to get together and do a bit of fellowship. We've got a process where you've got to register and obviously we take down information like what style of motorbike you've got and all of that sort of stuff. We then have breakfasts and coffee vans and all of those sorts of things provided.
It's really quite simple. It's just simply getting people together.
It's exactly what it is.
Things happen organically.
It's very true. The ride really did build itself, and I think it spoke to the fact that there was not a lot of there was a need for people to have a chat and talk about things, but not a lot was happening in that space. And this sort of predated Blue Trees and Are You Okay and that sort of things. And those organisations have done some fantastic work in getting the word out there and helping people understand that that there's a conversation to be had and that it's important to talk about it. So getting the word out there, having the mental health community recognise that discussion and destigmatising is a really important first step, and recognising that there are a bunch of organisations out there that can help people in this area. That's our job, you know, raising awareness, getting people the help that they need by raising that awareness and letting them know that there are options out there.
Yeah, I mean, there is a marked difference in the attitude to mental illness now, like compared to say 20 years ago or further. I mean, it really was the thing that you never spoke of, you know. So I think we've come an awfully long way, you know. Now, the money that you raise, how does that get used?
Well, the money's interesting because we don't set out to actually raise funds. Yes, it's an important part of what we do, but just as Steve wrote around Australia, his fundraising was accidental and incidental to the job. You know, we founded first and foremost to get awareness, raise awareness, and really sort of underscore the fact that there's a mental health epidemic out there, and it really needs to be addressed. The fundraising happens as a happy consequence of what we do, and you know, we make sure that the ride's accessible. So, you know, we've had our first price rise in our history this year, but we're affected with inflation like everybody else. You know, we still want to try and make sure that people get a ride patch and a sticker and that they're acknowledged correctly. So we provide that, and people collect them. I've lost my thread. Where is that going?
It's a fairly modest amount that you charge to get involved.
Fundraising. Okay, I'll get back to that. So since 2009, we've raised about $3 million.
Wow.
In various ways, shapes, and forms. And again, a lot of that comes from the entry fee, I suppose, if you like, people pay to go on a ride. But most of it comes from donations and fundraising. So, you know, our guys are, it is a modest entry fee, but each of our individual riders are generous to a fault, and you know, this is one way of them giving back. There's a story I love to tell. I was wearing my Black Dog Ride T-shirt, same one I've got on today, in fact, and I was in a petrol station down near North Cliff, which is in the southwest corner of Western Australia. You know, it's a very rural area, not a lot of people around, and I was filling up my car. I was not on a motorbike. I was in a car. And filling up the car, and a guy came up to me, tapped me on the shoulder, and pressed a $100 note into my hand. He'd noticed my T-shirt. He said that he was a local. He said that there'd been a few suicides in the past few years that had rocked the community, and that he'd heard about Black Dog Ride, and we had done some work in the community by, you know, helping fund some mental health first aid programs and things like that. He pushed $100 into my hand, said, "Look, I know you'll make sure this goes to the right place." It was one of those things that almost moved me to tears because he didn't know me. He just saw a bloke in a T-shirt, but he knew what that T-shirt represented, and this was, from the heart, grassroots donation. And that really is typically what we see. We don't get tens of thousands of dollars from corporate entities. Almost all of our donations are small dollar, gold coin, 10, 20 bucks, and that all adds up.
Yeah, well, it's situations like that that really sort of restore your faith in human nature when things like that happen. It's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Why are you supporting the Men's Shed? I mean, there's obviously a kind of involved in the same kind of business, really.
Well, look, the Men's Sheds, first of all, you know, do great work in the community. You know, men are disproportionately represented in the statistics, and we recognise that. Our involvement with Men's Shed sort of goes back to a couple of the sheds that approached us as they were setting up, and one example of that is Denmark, again in the southwest corner of WA. that that had set up from scratch, and they've built a magnificent facility there. But the local community, there's a very active Black Dog Ride in Denmark, Western Australia. Again, one of the very first rides that got set up, and they really the community really gets behind it. They reached out and said, "Look, you know, we're setting up a brand new shed. We'd love to we'd love your help." And we gave them a community grant, and they went out and bought some very much needed brand new machinery, and that helped get the shed up and running in a great way. Very soon after that, we were approached by a few other sheds, and we've helped them in various ways, shapes, and forms. And then we spoke to the Emma and Marty at Men's Shed head office in New South Wales there, and thought, well, you know, what is it we can do together? And you have this wonderful program called Shed Mates. It aligns perfectly with what we're trying to do in order to promote mental health and show people that there are options out there. And we felt that this was a great way to get behind the work that the Men's Shed does, but also ensure that the message of mental health is out there. And you know, we recognise that in partnering with the various Men's Sheds around the country helps us not only broaden our ability to raise awareness, which is our primary function, but it also provides many other options for us to work with the community and to work with like-minded people. And that's really sort of showing, bearing fruit now around the country. You know, there's many rides that'll be starting this year at Men's Shed locations. There's a couple in South Australia that I'm aware of, a couple in New South Wales. So, you know, these sorts of things are really important in that, you know, we're broadening our appeal, we're broadening our message, and we're talking to different people, not just people that ride motorbikes, but a broader message than that.
Fantastic. Now, I wish you every success on your one dayer, and you're also having a big one in October, aren't you? You're going to. I think everybody's going to meet in Fremantle. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So we've got, you know, we do our one day every year, and then every year also we do a long distance ride, and that's in the past we've met at various locations around Australia. We've been to Darwin. We've been to Tasmania. 2 years ago, we met in Alice Springs. We eventually got that one off the ground after two false starts due to COVID. And we got 450, 500 participants all meeting together in Alice Springs, which was awesome. That was also one of our very first programs in dealing with them, in you know, having a reception with the Men's Shed. And that was an enormous success. Out there in Blatherskite Park. I still love that name.
It's a great name, isn't it?
It's just lovely. So that was it. Sort of, it kind of sums up a lot of what our guys talk about.
They New egos, man. Guy,
you know, it's just wonderful. But that was a tremendous again. You know, a great showcase of how the Men's Shed gets behind what we do. We get behind what the Men's Sheds do, and the two organisations together are bigger and better because of it. So, you know, wonderful show of support there.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Lawson. That's been very informative, and I'm sure anybody out there that wants to get involved, all they got to do is look it up. It's there, and get involved, because it's not going to cost you a lot of money. And like you say, you know, just a one day out ride in the country, and it just brings the whole mental health issue to the fore, you know, which is great. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. Lord. Absolutely. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And thanks again for your support.
On the tools, on the Shed Wireless, with John Paul Young.
On the tools with Grant Robinson. Grant was interested in engineering from a young age. In fact, he pulled a car apart at the age of 12. He's since gone on to build a fire-breathing dragon on a bus, and in his latest project, he's been working with a company that's developing electric trucks.
1984, just 12 years old, you sold your train set and purchased your first car at 12 years old.
Yeah, I was lucky. I grew up on some property and we had a bit of space, and I bought a couple of broken down old Volkswagens. There was two of them, actually. I put the best parts off each of from both of them together and made a car out of them. So, yeah, that was my childhood. Very lucky to have a father who was allowed me to ruin all these tools.
I think we all went through that stage of grabbing something. Usually the alarm clock, I think, was favourite in my house. So pull that apart and never put it back together. I think I'm talking to somebody who actually did put it back together.
Yeah, I did get a few things back together. I certainly have made a lot of errors along the way as well. You know, anyone who's played with a car has blown something up or wrecked something, I'm sure. You haven't become a proper mechanic unless you've done something wrong.
I reckon. Well, I'll tell you what, a big leap forward. We'll go forward to 2018, and you have invented and built Bimmer. Is it Bimmer the Dragon?
It's Bimmer. Bimmer the Dragon, the fear-destroying dragon. It was an art project that I did to inspire people to, you know, be creative. I think creativity is one of the real essences of human experience. And in our busy lives, we forget to be creative. And I think that's something when we're in a creative flow, we're really in touch with our own true essence. So Bimmer the Dragon came about to inspire others to also start conversations about mental health and who we are and why we're here. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds amazing. You know, it's what to say. It's built on a bus.
It's built on a 40-foot bus. It's got a rooftop deck. It's got performance space for acrobatic circus performers, so we can hang lyras and all sorts of different hanging apparatuses for climbing acrobatic circus performers to hang off.
Oh, so where does it go to do these things?
I've taken it to about five different music festivals. I've also done a show in Sydney for the Inner West Council. They put together I've forgotten the name of the show, but it was a bunch of fire performers, fire artists.
Oh, yeah.
And we took Bimmer down for the show there, and I think that was in 2019. And then obviously COVID happened and things have gone quiet. But after COVID, I did manage to get it down to a festival called Dragon Dreaming, which is down near Wee Jasper.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I know Wee Jasper. Off to the left as you're heading down to Yast.
It's beautiful. It's such a beautiful place. I'd really recommend anyone that's travelling down there to go for a drive and go check out some of the lakes around Wee Jasper. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, there's a lot of this country, isn't there? And there's so much. It's absolutely beautiful, like you say. Now, the Bimmer, the reason why you built the thing, you know, it's now, does Bimmer come from any ancient sort of language, or is it something you've invented?
Good question, John. Actually, Bimmer the bus got named Bimmer when I was doing my yoga teacher training, and my yoga teacher named it Bimmer. And Bimmer is a character out of the Bhagavad Gita, which is where the Vedic sciences or the yogic teachings come from. Mm-hmm. And Bimmer is represents part of the mind, or they talk about the two parts of the mind, the thoughts that service and the thoughts that don't. And Bimmer is part of the family of the thoughts that do service, and he rises up in the story and slays all of the negative thoughts. And my bus got called Bimmer before the dragon idea even came about. And then when we turned it into a fire-breathing dragon, it just seemed appropriate that it became the fear-destroying dragon. So, yeah, it comes from those teachings, which is it's got a spiritual essence.
You've actually extended it yourself, you know, to a fire-breathing dragon. That's fantastic. The result of the choices you make, you must choose from a place of stillness. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, your life is a result of the choices you make. If you think about where you've ended up, it's all because of the choices you've made, and it takes away the blame of, you know, blaming other people. You've made all the choices that you've made to get to where you are.
Yeah.
And we often have to have compassion because we do make a lot of silly mistakes along the way. So having compassion for ourselves is a tool that we need to look in when we're looking into our past. We be okay with where we've been, but finding stillness to make particularly important choices is a real amazing quote that I really resonate with, and I use that quite a lot in my life when I'm making big decisions. It's like, well, just quieten your mind and really tune into what's right for you. So,
and is it working, Grant? Is it working? Yeah. Can you go back and think of all the, you know, difficult choices to make? And I suppose that the question really is, are you happy with the way things have gone?
I'm super happy at the moment. I'm living in the Central Coast, and I've got a beautiful garden, and life has turned out really quite well. Mm-hmm. And we're constantly engaging with our community around here and making ourselves, you know, I've only been here for 2 years now, but it's a really blessed life. My partner's studying permaculture, and we're trying to grow as much food as we can. In fact, she's actually part of the board of the Women's Shed, which is just a new entity that's coming up now, which I don't know too much about at this stage, but it's she's really getting into that in a big way.
Oh, that's great. I mean, I don't know if you know or not, but the Men's Shed, the whole movement started because of women.
Perfect. I did hear that episode,
So, you know, it's something that I really like to tell people about because, you know, I mean, even my own granddaughter said, oh, Men's Shed sounds a bit sexist. But I had to straighten her out. Well, on to something even more exciting than your fire-breathing dragon is your latest job, getting involved in electrification of prime movers.
So Janos, or Janus, however you'd like to pronounce it, is the Greek god of transition.
Uh-huh. And
it's actually a two-faced god. It's he's looking forwards and looking backwards, and it's at that transition point, which is appropriate name for a truck company that's doing their best to show that these, you know, once we've shown that these things are a possibility, the acceptance is much easier to come about. But trying to imagine a fully electric triple road train that's capable of pulling over 100 ton of ore or anything, actually, is quite a feat that a lot of people don't think is possible. But we have the technology to do this, and the transition phase of how we go about moving away from fossil fuels into a cleaner environment is the transport industry, and particularly trucking in Australia, does consume a lot of diesel. And I'm not a believer that full electric is going to replace all our needs in the very short term, or even over the next 50 years. We're going to need a full suite of solutions to solve the problems that we've got in front of us.
Yeah.
But having the option to have a fully electric truck, and having a swappable battery technology that Janos has developed, changes the playing field for the trucking companies, because you now have, basically, I'll explain to the listeners that a prime mover truck, and where the diesel tanks were between the front wheels and the back, they've removed the diesel tanks, and that's where a 4 ton of battery goes, 2 ton on either side, and it's installed with a forklift at the moment, and takes about 5 minutes to change these batteries. It's very similar to any power tool that you'd have in your shed that runs off a battery. Yeah. These things are massive. Yeah, and so they come out of the truck. They go into a charger. The charger's as big as a shipping container, and you can get your truck back on the road once with a fresh new battery within 5 minutes. And for a trucking company that's running a circular loop, i.e. they've got a truck that goes from the mine to the port and back, mm-hmm. it's very easy to electrify that route. And particularly when we've got trucks that have been doing that same route for, you know, their whole life, they can rack up 1 million kilometres on the same route. Putting one charger and a couple of sets of batteries, we now have a fully electric truck that is doing that route, and we've captured that corner of the market. So it's quite an exciting technology. I'm interested to see the pickup and the adoption of it. Once these circular routes are electrified, we then start to look at how we electrify between capital cities. And so we'd most likely they'd be looking at doing Sydney to Melbourne, which is one of the main transport routes. Yeah. And you'd have charge and change stations like swap and go gas bottles. You'd have a charge and change station every 2 hours, and truck driver would pull in, swap the batteries, have a bit of a feed, and it's back on the road again without needing to wait for those batteries to charge up.
Yeah. Now, in China, are they not doing that just with normal vehicles, just with passenger vehicles?
They are. There's the challenges with private vehicles is that we'd like to go wherever we want to go whenever we want to go there.
Yeah.
Whereas trucking companies, they use a lot more fuel and they have set routes, and so to target that is much. It's a faster way to reduce our diesel consumption.
I totally agree. It really is. Yeah. Now you're also involved in a robotic system to deploy utility scale solar arrays. So I mean, I take it that's when you have a large paddock, I suppose, full of solar panels and flog it back to the electricity people. Is that the sort of thing?
Yeah. So 5B, they've developed a folding solar array. So it's pre-manufactured in a factory. 100 panels. It folds up like a concertina. Mm-hmm. And you pick it up and you unfold it and you instantly have 30 kilowatts worth of solar panels pre-wired, ready to plug in. Mm. Now, you do that multiple times, you can roll out a colossal size utility scale solar array in an incredible time. Now, when you're looking at the amount of solar that the world is going to be rolling out over the next 20 years, the speed at which we need to do that is phenomenal. Talking about, you know, train loads of solar panels just to build these things. We were doing the numbers on we were tendering to do the Sun Cable gig, which was Mike Cannon Brooks's
thing.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's still on the cards, but it's still. But they were talking about a train that's a kilometre long, arriving every 2 days, and having to be fully unloaded and deployed before the next train arrives. Now, the only way we're going to do that is to have it fully automated and very organized, much like a port. You know, you have these robotic machines moving around shipping containers. We were developing a robotic platform to unfold these solar arrays. So very impressive stuff. It's under development at the moment, and they've got the mechanism automated for unloading the solar arrays off the machine. There's GPS guidance that needs to be added to these things, but that's a very exciting project what 5B are working on there with their folding solar arrays. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to the building industry, because that's your latest thing involved, thermal performance and sustainability. Do you get frustrated when you see new housing estates with black roofs?
Look, they are working towards solving a lot of this, and roof colour actually is assessed during all new thermal performance assessments. It makes a big difference. We should be looking at, you know, more reflective colours. But the changes that are coming in, most new buildings now have to have a 7-star rating. They need to be very well insulated. The legislation that they've brought in to make sure that we are building houses that service into the future, I think is quite exciting. We're going to dramatically reduce our energy consumption in heating and cooling of these spaces.
Is orientation part of that?
Huge part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they have a modelling package where all the spaces and the window orientations are put into the modelling package. It then tells you what areas need to be improved on, where windows need to be either double glazed or heavily shaded, or how to go about getting to that 7-star rating. And it takes into account what air conditioners are installed, what water heating systems are used, whether there's solar going on the roof. So it's a full encompassing process that we need to be looking at for our new builds.
I've just made an exciting discovery, Grant. I've just made an exciting discovery with my air conditioning and put it on dehumidify.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's almost as good as having the compressor running.
Well, you know, it takes the heat out of the air because you're pulling the moisture out of the air.
Yeah.
And that's where most of the heat exists. Water has a fairly high thermal mass. So once you start to get humidity out, it's so much nicer.
Yes. Yeah. I was frankly quite amazed.
You know? Yeah.
And, of course, we're saving money.
Brilliant. Yeah. Look, we're going to get much better at this. I think Australians' housing has always been rushed together as quickly as possible because we're in, you know, such a desperate need for housing. But we've realised now that we have to go back and fix them all up and put better walls in and better insulation.
Yeah.
So let's just do it from the start.
Yeah, exactly. I got a bit of a bump. My house was built in 1920s.
it's quite funny. This place I'm in is built in the 1960s, and it's one step up from a tent.
I know exactly what you mean. Well, Greg, thank you very much for that. It's been very informative indeed. And you're not the sort of bloke that sits around wondering. You get there and you do it, and I think it's just fantastic. And hopefully we'll talk to you in the future. And
I look forward to it, John. And
get an update. Yeah.
Maybe I'll bring Beamer down to one of the men's sheds one weekend.
Oh, yeah. No, that'd be something.
Have a bit of a party.
Yes. Yeah. Or we'll come and visit you up there or down there at the Central Coast. Not a problem.
Good on you, John. Toodaloo.
Thanks again, Grant.
On the Pulse on the Shed Wireless.
G'day everyone, I'm Stuart Torrance, Shed Development Coordinator, Wellbeing and Health for the Australian Men's Shed Association. Each year, there are dates set aside for all types of health and life matters that are important enough that we should take time to think about them. You know what I mean, skin cancer, heart, diabetes, awareness days, weeks, months. Well, this webinar isn't about health per se, but it does have a lot to do with our families and our own well-being when you consider all the things involved. August has a day called Dying to Know Day, and there's an advanced care planning week in March each year. So today we're going to speak about end of life and death itself. I know, a very morbid subject, but an important one all the same. In my previous role working with people impacted by dementia, seminars and workshops on these topics were very well attended, and I must say I was surprised by the interest. To help us investigate this topic, I'd like to introduce Imelda Woods. A little disclaimer here, Imelda is a family friend who comes highly recommended and has worked in numerous roles within the funeral services industry or market. Welcome, Imelda. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you, Stuart. And thank you so much for inviting me to share this very important topic and one that's very dear and near to my heart.
Absolutely. Yeah. Imelda, tell us how did you come to the decision to make a career change and go into the funeral services industry?
Well, to be honest, it was actually the area is an interest that I've had for quite a while. For probably many and varied reasons, but I had obviously the sad situation. I lost my mum when I was quite young. I lost a dear family friend, an auntie, and then more recently my dad. So having been there on that side of things and seeing, you know, how it's like for people who lose loved ones. All my years of customer service and dealing with people in other aspects and other roles and industries, I just felt that I could bring something just a little more to that role, you know, if I were to get in that industry. And it was just it was almost like a calling. So it's actually quite bizarre, but it was almost like a calling. So
I can see how you would come alongside somebody and just be able to take them through the process whilst navigating their grief and loss and so on. I think you'd be absolutely wonderful at doing that.
Thank you so much.
Thinking about where to start on this topic, you know, I can see why some might be overwhelmed at the time due to their grief and the sensitivity and the emotions. So let's start at the beginning. They say location, location, location. Is there a good place to die?
Well, in my experience dealing with this, with families, I would say, and just from life itself knowing, I think most people would say that they would prefer, if they had a choice, to die at home, to pass away at home, surrounded by friends and family, and in a familiar place. But, you know, this is all dependent on you know, the circumstances leading up to someone's death. I mean, sometimes, you know, health obviously has a determining factor. So, you know, you may find that you are in hospital and you have actually no choice. So, but when this does happen, you know, if the time comes when nothing more can be done, there's services there that can help people navigate and get through that, the family as well as the dying, that allow them to remain at home. So such as receiving palliative care or hospice care.
I was about to say you I think you're talking about palliative care, but
yes,
Imelda, I've also heard of and I always say it wrong, a death doula.
Yes.
Like, I don't think it's a jeweler because I don't think they fight a lot. I think they actually come alongside.
They do.
Doula, is it?
Yeah. They're called a death doula. There are such people as birth doulas as well. And they both do a similar role. Obviously, a birth doula will be there for an expectant mum. And a death doula obviously is there to provide support for someone dying and support for their loved ones as well. Especially so. They don't provide any medical care, but as such, that would be carried out by the palliative care team. But death doulas are there sometimes more of a spiritual support, emotional, physical, and also a very important respite opportunity for loved ones that are in that situation with their loved ones. So, they do provide a role.
The palliative care side of things, now that is medical care, is that right?
Yes, palliative care usually focuses on the medicinal side of things. So they're looking at your comfort and just an all-round, you know, making you comfortable, but they do look at the administration of any medicines and things that you may need. Whereas someone choosing to go into hospice care, at that point in time, they've made a decision not to have any more intervention medically. So the support there is just very much you know, along their emotion and well-being and comfort, if that makes sense. So
yeah. things like an advanced care directive would be something that they would utilize to help them through that process to ensure that they're following your wishes.
Exactly. Yep, that is exactly right. So that's exactly what they would do. You know, it's and look, there's no, from my experience, little that I've seen, no right or wrong. And I think it's a wonderful thing that people have these choices. So it's a very personal, very personal journey, obviously, for that person. So
okay, Imelda, we need to push on, but we've only just started. We've only just touched on things. getting this all organized, my mind's blown away. It's like we haven't even passed away yet, and already there's things to organise.
Yeah,
how do people get on with this planning of a funeral?
Yeah, well, look, in my experience, I think from what I've dealt with families, and I've seen people in all manner of you know, where their head's at, and some people cope very well, others don't as much. What I would say, though, is I think it's very, very important for everyone to just let their loved ones know what their wishes are, and whether that be an informal chat to their nearest and dearest, or looking at and putting in something in place, enduring guardianship, or simply just having it written in your will, if you have a will, just so there's something there. So there's nothing worse than putting that extra burden on family at such an awful time, with they just have no idea what your wishes were. So. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really important.
I think it's so important to put those things in place.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm.
Okay. I think that's a great point, being prepared and letting people know what you want, and advanced care planning. If people would like to look up the advanced care planning website, they have a lot of resources on there in regards to being able to write all those things down and get things prepared. I know my parents wanted to be buried instead of cremated, but I wasn't aware of that until we actually had this conversation. Yeah. So let me ask you, what kind of services are there available when it comes to how we are to be interned?
Okay, well, funny you should say, cremation, there is obviously cremation, and cremation seems to be the most popular choice these days. Having said that,
can I ask, is that because of cost?
I think it's got a lot to do with cost. Burials still have their place, don't get me wrong. I've done many burials. And a lot of the time it can be down to religious reasons as well, that someone chooses to have a burial over a cremation. Yeah. Religious and cultural beliefs play a big role in the choice that people make, but yes, of course, cost can be a factor, and cremation is definitely a more economical choice. Burials can, depending on what where you're buried, and all sorts of, a lot of factors come into play. Definitely more expensive option for people, but. But again, like I said, different faiths and culture do play a big part in that. But and you can also with those, either one, you may choose to have a service, you may choose to have no service at all. So generally with a burial, though, there would be sometimes a church service, but it could just be a chapel service or a very simple service at home.
At home.
Right.
People, so you don't need to go to a formal location.
No, you do not. This is something I don't think people realise, and I would say to my families that would visit, obviously for me to assist them, please know that I'll make anything happen for you so long as it's legal. So we'll make it happen. There's no right or wrong when it comes to this. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know my mother-in-law wants to be sent up, or her ashes sent up with her dearly departed husband in fireworks.
Yes, I've heard of that.
Yeah, going out with
a
bang.
It is a thing. It is actually a thing. Wow. Yeah, you can do that. As far as cremated remains go, there's lots and lots of options. Some people choose to just be interred in a niche. It might be a memorial park where they just purchase a niche and their ashes are interred. Yeah. You might want to bring your loved one home, and then a nice urn, a nice something container of sorts to have your loved one in. Ashes also can be made into jewelry, stones, keepsakes of all sorts. So
wow,
lots of things, paperweights even. So you can choose to use your loved one as a paperweight.
I know a few relatives that could fit that description.
yeah. But yeah, no, there's lots of things in that space at the moment. So, and it's changing all the time. So yeah.
Okay, so what about me? What about being buried at sea? Can you still do that? They do it in the movies.
Yes, I know, Stuart. I know you did ask me about this and it set me on a quest. so I actually haven't had anyone ask me that before, so it was a good excuse to go digging.
And
yeah, surprisingly, you can do that. You can have be buried at sea. The one thing, obviously, that I would say, it does have a little bit of involvement. There is a permit needed, which obviously is going to be a cost. So I would think it would not be a cost-effective
option
for anyone. But apparently you are able to do it. So, and just on that note too, when we speak about having services or scattering ashes more so, if that's to happen in a public place, such as some beautiful garden somewhere or a park, just be mindful that the local authorities, the council, do need to be advised of what your intentions are. Absolutely.
But there'd be no permit required for that.
No permit for that, but just something.
Out of courtesy.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, so you wouldn't want to be reported by someone watching you and sort of have that sort of situation, you know, come about. So I think letting the council know your intention is definitely the best way to go there.
So okay, so I've got a head full of firecrackers going off, jewelry, paperweights, buried at sea. The costs are going through the roof and is skyrocketing. Is there any options that help you cover what I or my loved ones would like?
Yeah, look, there are some companies out there that offer funeral insurance as such. Now, I don't know much about these companies. I just know that they exist. What I would say as well, which is becoming very, very increasingly popular, is to prepay a funeral or prearrange. They call prepay. You might hear it called by a few different names. Most funeral directors do offer this service. When I say most, I mean probably the more major players in the market will definitely offer it as a service. The good thing about a prepaid situation is that you get to put everything in that agreement that what your wishes are. So there's no guesswork for family. Mm. The other thing is that it is paid for up front. You do enter into a contract, it's paid for up front, and that money's held in trust. And then when the time comes, obviously it's all put into place. Now, the reason I think it's gaining in popularity is that, as we all know, costs don't ever go down, do they? They always seem to go north and go up. So whatever you pay for whatever the cost is at the time of signing that contract, it is locked in place and that is honoured at the time of your passing. So you know, costs of all sorts of things would go up, you know, not just coffins and floral and it might be the celebrant, anything, everything. So everything is taken care of without any extra cost, unless, of course, your family choose to add anything at the time. So it's a great, okay, a great way of going. There might also be some help, government assistance for some people. That's a space I'm not too familiar with, but I have heard that on occasion, depending on someone's situation, there may be some subsidies available to help and assist people as well.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
So plenty to investigate and plenty to look into in regards to planning a funeral. Mm-hmm. But, you know, along with, you know, if you wait until the actual event, mm-hmm. you're hanging around with a lot of loss and grief and you're dealing with that side of things. And then to be able to sort of navigate the paperwork and putting through the service and all them sort of things, can you help me with that? Who can help me through that process?
Absolutely. Well, that's where we come into play. So that's what funeral directors are there for. So, and some people, there's options now where you're able to do everything online yourself, very budget-friendly situation. Mm-hmm. However, I personally don't think that's for everybody, not only people that aren't very tech savvy, but also too, it's such a very, very hard emotional time, a very emotionally charged time. It's kind of the last thing you feel like doing, whereas if you go and engage the services of a funeral director, that's their job, and they will they will take care of everything. You know, they're there to offer guidance and support. They will facilitate everything, all aspects of arranging the service, if there is one, and subsequent cremation or burial. Depending on where your loved one has passed, they will take care of transferring your loved one into care, any mortuary requirements. They do all the liaison with the celebrants, with clergy, if it's a church service. They book all the venue, coffin choice, floral choices. But that's just the start. You know, there's also the regulatory documentation, there's permits, there's certificates, and then rite of burial for a burial. There's quite a lot of paperwork involved with organising a funeral, and you kind of don't really know until you've got to do it. It's not something, not a purchase we make every day, thank goodness. So, yeah.
Thank goodness for that.
Yeah.
And with me, then there's the hire of the boat and the captain and all the other bits and pieces.
Absolutely.
You mentioned flowers, floral choices.
Yes.
Crikey, we haven't even touched on flowers as yet, and I don't even think we should go there because that opens a whole new can of worms.
Imelda,
you've taken us through what is a very difficult subject, and I think you've enlightened us greatly in regards to what can and can't do, and I really thank you for your words of advice and your thoughts on the matter.
You're so very
do you have anything further that you'd like to add?
Look, I just think the best thing to say to anyone listening is try not to be too afraid of it. It is something that we're all going to have to go through. And I think the kindest thing you can do for your family is to be a little aware and open, but also ask for help, ask for support. Mm-hmm. Certainly if you're engaging with a funeral director or trying to navigate on your own, ask for support and help, you know, a family member, a friend, to be there to assist you. But, it's a very individual thing. Yeah, it's a fact of life. It's a fact of life, but a very individual thing. So for me, it's not a job. It's an honour to guide people through such a terrible time for them personally. So thank you for letting me share just some thoughts and ideas and in this role that I just find so, so fulfilling. Yeah,
fantastic.
It's amazing.
Imelda, thank you very much for joining me on the Shed Wireless today for our On the Pulse subject, or in this case, with no pulse. Well, that wraps us up for another season, another session of the Shed Wireless. JPY, back to you.
Nailed it. Nailed it. Nailed it.
Nailed it with Rick Woodchip.
G'day, Shedders, Rip Woodchip here. How are you all going today? Well, another one bites the dust. Yeah, Shedders, we lost another Shed brother this week. Seems to be a bit of a reoccurring theme down at the Shed. I mean, we're all one foot in the grave and another one on the banana peel at our age, but you never really see it coming, nor do you know just when you're not going to see someone again. So, it can have a way of knocking you around a bit, and it also makes you consider your own impending doom. And whether or not you've done what you were meant to do. And when the time does come, can you be reasonably satisfied with your contribution to the world? Which leads you to ask those rhetorical questions like, what's it all about? Was there a plan? Did I play me part? Did I make a difference? And was I part of the greater good of the world, even if I wasn't a Nelson Mandela or a Mother Teresa? How will I be remembered if I'm to be remembered at all? Because you just never know when you're going to wake up dead, do you? I mean, for a certain amount of life, you just think you're going to live forever, and you take it all for granted, even so far as to cheat death at times, and be a little bit blasé about life, because you think that dying's just for old people. But then, I reckon when you hit about 50, you start to consider the fact that you're well and truly playing on the back nine of the course, and you either want to start hitting some birdies, or just go sit in a clubhouse and reflect on your first nine holes. You hear what I'm saying, Shedders? And then, well, it gets to being too late. And some of the decision-making can be taken out of your hands somewhat. Your capabilities certainly can leave your ideas well behind. My old man planned his end, I reckon. Whether he had it in his head that much that he manifested it or not, I don't know. But it happened just the way he wanted it. Well, too soon, that's for sure. But he never wanted to be a burden on anyone. He just wanted to go on his terms. And he pretty much did. When he got sick, he organised his affairs. And when the hospital visits and the operations were becoming too much and he had no real quality of life left, I reckon he just willed himself to go. I always knew that bastard could do anything. So, at our age, you got to start to prioritise. What is the most important thing to me? What makes me happy? And in turn, what can I do to make everyone and anyone I care about happy during my extended stay? And you got to make sure you say what you have to say and say it often so they don't forget. I reckon the best way is to not fear it and don't fight it. Just do your best to prolong it. Because death is just a part of life. And for goodness sakes, get your affairs in order. Don't leave it up to others to sort out your bloody mess and have to worry about something they shouldn't have to be worrying about at one of probably the most saddest times of their lives. Make sure the decisions are all made and communicated. And all accounts are up to date so they can just get on with the grieving and then get on with living their own best lives. Sooner the better. Anyway, Shedders, I'm going to go make a couple of important phone calls, I reckon, while I think of it. Okay, Shedders, see you next time. Bye!
Now, don't forget, if any of our segments has brought up anything distressing for you, please call the Crisis Support Service Lifeline on 131114. There's something magical about cruising down the highway with the perfect soundtrack playing in the background. And we're here to explore the tunes that make those journeys unforgettable. So buckle up, roll down the windows, and let's hit the road with the ultimate road trip playlist. And also, special acknowledgement to Ken Newton from the Australian Caravan Club. We spoke to Ken last year, and Ken has since passed away. So this is a bit of a tribute for Ken and our long-serving reporter, Butch, who's still missing up at Cape York. Okay, we're going for a wander down the track to Max Music Shack, and we're going to talk about some travelling songs this week, aren't we, mate?
That's right, that's right. Originally it was road trip, but hey, I've managed to work in just about every form of transport there is into the into the list.
Now, this first one's interesting because everybody associates this song with, well, I do anyway, I associate it with the Rolling Stones, but It's got a nicer history than that.
Yeah, well, the Stones copied Chuck Berry's version, almost note for note. But even though the lyrics are so good, everybody thinks that it, Chuck Berry wrote it, but he didn't. It was written by a jazz pianist, Bobby Troup, who was on a cross-country trip across America, and he was trying to write a song based on the highway they were on, the I-40. He was struggling with it, and his wife said, why don't we write it about Route 66 and say, get your kicks on Route 66? And he thought, she's right.
And this version is amazing. Nat King Cole, I didn't even know he did it.
Yeah, it's very back in his early jazz days when he sat at the piano, and yeah, it's a great voice.
Okay, now we're talking about Chuck Berry. Let's go.
Well, I think Chuck, after he had a hit with Route 66, he thought, well, you know, I'd rather have the songwriting royalties for himself. So he wrote another song about crossing America. He's on the bus, then a train, then a plane. It's it's pure poetry, as usual, from Chuck
Trains
Berry, The Promised Land.
At Ray Charles, now, I really do. I remember when I was like 9 or 10 and seeing this on TV, Ray Charles with Hit the Road Jack and the Rayettes, you know, and it just, it kind of reminded me of my own family, actually, just watching the girls singing out, bellowing out these answers in the song, and you know, because being Scottish, the ladies in my family were very loud.
Yes, and Ray Charles is great with his feigned shock at being asked to hit the road, Jack. And then we got Fats Domino. This is the first time I ever heard Fats Domino, and I loved the song. It was a hit in the 60s when his fame had faded a little bit, and yeah, hey, what more to say? I love it.
All right. Now, for all you truckies out there, here's one. A ripper, 6 days on the road.
Yes. Well, this was probably the first of the trucking songs, and Dave Dudley, who wrote the song and sang it, he gave away a bit of a truckie secret, I think. He's swallowing little white pills and his eyes are open wide. And eventually his record company got him to re-record it and they changed that line. But yeah, this is the original version.
Well, yeah, but that was in the old days. That doesn't happen anymore.
No.
And another road song, the one that everybody should know and everybody would have heard, especially in our age bracket, Roger Miller.
Yeah, a great song, great country song. And sung very convincingly, I think.
Now, Marty Wild and Abba Gavini, it surprised me you put this one in. I mean, it's because I'm a commercial music nut. I love pop songs, and you've stuck this one in, big pop song.
I love pop music as well, and it's probably about the only song in the playlist that's about a road trip.
And Canned Heat, as I said once before, I thought they were Canadian, but they're not.
Not my understanding. They came out of that big era in San Francisco, the Haight-Ashbury Summer of Love time.
Uh-huh.
They were probably the only real blues group that made the pop charts in the 60s anyway. But in San Francisco, all sorts of, rock and roll started being called rock music, because there were so many diverse strands to it, and I've got a few examples here. Steppenwolf with their what became a biker anthem, "Born to Be Wild."
It amazes me, this track.
Yeah,
it sounds like, you know, it just holds up all these years later. You know, it's just an amazing track.
I love that when he get the motor running and he does that big organ chord. You know,
I remember. You know, we used to play this song in the band. I was, you know, my old band Elm Tree way back in 1968, 69, you know, it's incredible. Anyway, let's go again. Let's more travelling. Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Yeah, he's flying around the country in his little travelling band, and this song was written as a tribute to Little Richard, and John Fogerty's vocal is a great tribute to Little Richard. And then we got The Doors, where Jim Morrison, for once in his life, gives some very sober advice. The first couple of lines are, keep your eyes on the road and your hands upon the wheel, although he blots his copybook later on when he sings, woke up this morning and I got myself a beer. Probably not the ideal advice for a road trip.
It's a shame there's not a lyric in there about use your indicators. That's my latest. That's my latest. Big whinge on the road.
yes. And then a Dutch band who were one-hit wonders, but they had a friend of mine was a very big fan of theirs and had all of their albums. So they were a quality band. And probably not the safest advice in this song either, because he's talking about some telepathic lovemaking with his girlfriend while he's on the road. So he could be a little distracted.
It's a great track, though. Yeah, it really is one of my favourites.
It is.
Now, we couldn't talk about driving or road trips without Akka Dakka.
That's right.
And that highway to...
Highway to hell. They never did anything by halves, Akka Dakka. No. And, you know, if you're going to be on a highway, you may as well be on a highway to hell, I guess.
Now, good story with this one.
Yes.
Two of us from the Beatles.
That's right. It was written around about the time of the Let It Be sessions, and Paul McCartney always said it was about him and his wife being out for a Sunday drive and getting caught in the rain. But that doesn't hold up if you listen to the lyrics. I think he was appealing to John Lennon's good nature and remembering their very long friendship and all of the things they'd had to do. And I think it's about when they were first in Hamburg... They had a bit of a prank and there was a fire. The police were called, and George was only 17. He was deported immediately, and the drummer Pete Best's mother was rich. She sent him an airfare. That left John and Paul penniless to make their way home. And they had no money, so they had to survive by shoplifting. They did a couple of burglaries.
Wow.
And if you listen to the lyrics of the song, some of them is lighting matches and lifting latches. And
no, where's our clean-cut Beatles?
And spending other people's hard-earned pay. And then at one stage, McCartney sings, "You and I have memories longer than the road that stretches out ahead." That ain't about a woman that he met 12 months before, I don't
think. No, yeah, I suppose you're right there. Now, we couldn't do anything without Elvis.
Always got to get Elvis in.
Got to get him in there. Yeah.
And this song, it's probably the first time that Elvis defied the Colonel. The Colonel's rule was if you wanted Elvis to record your song, you had to give them the publishing, which meant half of the songwriting royalties went to them. Jerry Reed, who wrote the song, he refused, and they said, "Well, you know, you'd make hundreds of thousands of dollars off it." He said, "I don't care. It's my song." They said, "Well, we'll burn the..." He said, "I don't give a bugger what you do," and walked out of the studio. And Elvis was so desperate for this to be his next single that he defied the Colonel and they put it out.
Oh, Jerry Reed is just... He's such a... I mean, what an amazing lyricist he was. You know, yeah. She got the gold mine, I got the shaft.
That's exactly the one I was thinking of. Yeah. Yes, he was something else.
Okay, now from Elvis to Graceland.
Yeah, well, you see what I'd done there.
I do.
So Paul Simon's on a road trip. He's with his 9-year-old son going down to the holy altar of Elvis at Graceland's, of course.
Yeah. Now, the Eagles, this is one of their very early ones.
This is their first hit, actually, and it was mostly written by Jackson Brown. Glenn Frey from the Eagles was desperate to record this song for their first album, but Jackson Brown couldn't finish it. And in the end, Glenn Frey said, "Look, give me the bloody thing. I'll finish it." And he did. And it ended up on their first album and a huge hit.
And I see what you've done again. You've done it again. We were talking about Jackson Brown, and here he is.
Yes, and this was a great album, Running on Empty. What he did was he went on tour and he took about 3 buses. One of them had a recording deck in it, and he wrote and recorded the album on the road.
Fabulous. And we finish off with the quintessential road trip song, Willie Nelson, On the Road Again.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd give you an opportunity to tell your Willie Nelson joke.
Oh, yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Because I did, I threw this one out at the one of the meetings at the men's shed the other day. I said, "Well, you know Willie's dead, don't you?" And they all said, "Oh, really?" I said, "Yeah, how did he die?" "Well, he was playing on the road again." Boom, boom. And with that, we'll leave Mac's Music Shack until the next exciting episode. Thanks again, Mac.
Thank you, Youngie.
Remember, you can listen to Mac's playlist on the AMSA YouTube channel. Simply head to YouTube and search Mac's Music Shack, where you'll find all the songs that we've mentioned in today's chat. What's been happening in your shed? What projects have you been tinkering with? I'd love to see some pictures of what you're doing. Drop me an email to theshedwireless@menshed.net. And remember, share your favourite podcast with your shedding mates. Give them a hand to subscribe if you can, or send them to www.menshed.org/theshedwireless. Until next time, folks, for the love of shedding.
Wood or fabricating metal is the thing you understood. Whatever is your game, everyone's the same. Yeah, we can do it all at the Men's Shed. Short, fat, tall, skinny, hairy, bald. In the shed, it's welcome one and all. Share the skills you know, we're all having a go. There's a helping hand.